Okay, it is now recording. Whatever it's recording on, it is now recording. You can obtain this recording from QVC. No. You can. Right. You can get this recording by contacting my secretary, Rebecca Bagan, and she will help you. I neglected last week, although it's on the schedule, I neglected last week to mention that we would be doing this on Tuesday. And so I thought, rather than moving forward with chapter 16, what I would do is point out some other aspects of chapter 15, because that way, I was just about to take my jacket and put this on here, because that way people who are missing it won't feel like they missed the forward advance of the Torah. And also, I found some nice stuff that I want to share with you. Part of the dilemma of studying the Torah is that if you make the mistake of opening up a book or two about something you already studied, you have to go back again because it's just infinite, and you can't ever feel like you finish a section of the Torah. That's why in the Talmud, when you finish a tractate of the Talmud, there is a blessing that begins Hadran Alach, which is usually translated as "We will return to you." The idea being that you never finish with it, so you constantly return to it. And if you recall, in chapter 15, let's just go back over the chapter for a second. It's a very good chapter, by the way, for on the week of Thanksgiving, since everything gets carved up with the bird. Right. So there is a sacrifice, obviously. And then I was taking a look for other things in this book, and I thought I would leaf through and see what it has to say about our Parsha. And let me first tell you that this is one of those, I doubt that it's still in print. It's a Hebrew book. It was printed in Israel in 1956. Harav Mordechai Kohen, Al HaTorah. The only reason that I'm in possession of this book is because it was part of my father's library. And so I inherited it from him, which is good not only because it's wonderful to have and it's always nice to have books from a parent, but also because he read through a lot of this and he's checked off some of the good ones. So I can automatically go to some of the stuff that he already checked off. And I decided that since, in particular, we should stick with chapter 15 today instead of moving forward, that I would share with you a couple of the comments that Rav Mordechai Kohen makes about this chapter, and in particular, two. If you'll look in chapter 15, we're going back to the third verse at the very beginning, when God says, God says to him, your reward will be very great. And Abraham says, how can I get a great reward when I have no kids? Because if I die childless, there's no reward. And, okay, and God says, God says, the word of the Lord, in verse 4, I'm sorry, since you grant me no offspring, my steward will be my heir. The word of the Lord came to him in reply, the one shall not be your heir, none but your own very issue shall be your heir. He took him outside and said, look toward the heaven and count the stars if you're able to count them. So shall your offspring be. And because he put his trust in God, he reckoned it to his merit. Okay, so that's the first thing. Look at the sky and count the stars. We talked last time about different interpretations of why he has him count the stars. We have here four or five from Rabbi Mordechai Kohen. He says, first of all, if you look in the Midrash, in the rabbi's comments, Nimshalu Yisrael HaKochavim, Israel is compared to the stars. Why are Israel compared to the stars? He gives, first of all, every star is a world in itself, and so is every human being. That's the first reason that you're, even though they may all look alike to us, in fact, each one is a world. So first of all, stars are like people because, well, he says like Israel, but like people because everyone's a world. Second, and this is the opposite of the first in a way, he says from Earth, you really only get illumination in the sky when stars are clustered together. A single star doesn't give that much light. And the same thing's true of Israel. Only when we're clustered together do we give illumination. That's the second reason he gives. The third reason he gives, even though stars look small, they're really large. Even though Israel appears small, its impact is large in the world. We talked about that time, about that one last time. And then this, which seems obvious and we didn't talk about last time, but it's really beautiful. He says, Ma kochavim halalu ein uram nekar ela b'shcheshchat halayla. You can only see the light of stars in the dark of night. And when does Israel shine? In the darkest times of its history. Which I thought was a really beautiful idea. It's almost like a Rembrandt portrait, which always comes out of the darkness. Right? I read recently, in fact, I wrote this up for an article in Schma, that Da Vinci, in contrast to every other painter, used to tell painters always to paint against a black wash, not a white wash. That you always should start with black, which is, of course, how the world begins, out of darkness. Right? So God and Da Vinci share this. All right, let me just finish with the, 1 second. And then it says, he says as a continuation of that, remember that the world begins in night, but goes on to day. And the same thing in the case of Israel, that though it starts off with sadness, darkness, and so on, the day follows and there is light. And then he quotes a verse from Isaiah that talks about darkness and fog and the way in which the sun rises on it and streams light through it. Yes?
I was just going to say that while it wasn't known to human beings at the time of obviously this writing or that writing, we now know, and presumably God always knew, that the stars that we see, most of them burned out long before we ever see.
He might have known this. This is 1956. So he might have known this. I don't know what his scientific, right.
I think the idea is really nice that, you know, we go on shining a light.
Right. It is a very nice idea. I don't know if the ancient Greeks were aware of that or not. They may have been. They knew an awful lot. In fact, it's interesting to realize, I mentioned this, I think, here once before, and I even said part of that the ancient Greeks knew that the Earth was round. We lost that in the Middle Ages. But the ancient Greeks knew, and one of the ways that Aristotle knew, do you remember? I told you how Aristotle knew, is because the shadow of the Earth on the moon is curved. After all, don't forget, he knew that the moon is interposed between the Earth and the sun, and that it gets blocked, and why is the shadow curved? He figured because the Earth had to be curved. So they had pretty accurate, the ancient Babylonians had pretty accurate calculations too of orbits and things like that. But it's not only true that knowledge is gained, knowledge is also lost sometimes. It has to be rediscovered. You know, if you read, it's very interesting, if you read certainly the book review pages, but also if you read any cultural, art, music, people are always being rediscovered. All the time, you know? I mean, a biography just came out about Sam Cooke and talked about the rediscovery, who was a very fine popular singer in the 50s. And the only reason that things have to be rediscovered is because people forget. They just forget. I promise you, I'm sure nobody will remember to, but I promise you that in 20 years, nobody will read or have heard of the Da Vinci Code. I promise you. Because there are equally popular books. If you look at the bestseller lists of the 60s and the 50s, not only don't you know the books, you've never heard of the authors. The most popular, for the 20s and 30s, the most popular author, as popular as any author today, was a man named Joseph Hergesheimer. Nobody ever heard of him. Nobody ever reads any of his books. the poor guy. But he had a good run. And what happens to popular authors, people that everybody knows, happens that much more to authors who are good but don't have such popularity. So the same thing happens with human knowledge. It gets periodically rediscovered. So that's anything more on stars. Then he has a really beautiful comment here about when the verse where it says, verse 13, and he said to Abram, know well that your offspring shall be strangers in a land not theirs. Okay? Now, is that a blessing or a curse? Curse, right? Curse. I don't see any way you can make that into a blessing. But Rabbi Mordechai Kohen does. He has a really remarkable and beautiful passage on it, and this is what he says. Zo besorah tova. This is good news that there'll be strangers in the land not there. He shall be sar kadosh baruch hu et Abraham. Because he says, even if they are comfortable in that land, they will know that is not their land. They are strangers. In other words, Abraham, don't think that they will ever feel at home anywhere but Israel. You shouldn't worry that they'll be in other lands and think this is where I belong. They'll always know, as long as they're not in Israel, they're strangers. And this is supposed to be comforting to him, which is really just a brilliant and beautiful interpretation of this, that God is promising Abraham that even though all of this is going to happen in the end, they're going to be all right, and they are going to be, they're going to rest easy in Israel. Now, as we go on, of course, there is also the question in verse 16 of the iniquity of the Amorites, that the land is promised to you, but the Amorites haven't been sinful enough yet for the land to be yours. And here's one of the things that makes the Bible so both interesting and in its way problematic. And that is that this verse implies that you only get to hold on to the land if you're virtuous. And if you're not virtuous, then you get kicked out of the land, right? Which is a theory that we know is supposed to apply to Israel, but we didn't know that it was supposed to apply to other nations. But at least here, it seems like it applies to other nations. The Amorites get to stay there because they're not guilty enough yet. But when they are guilty enough, they will no longer have to stay in that land. Can you think of any way that this applies historically? Great Britain. How?
Well, they had so much land and so unvirtuously, and they basically shrunk back to a...
All colonial powers who have land, I mean, and it's not just Britain, you can think of Rome, I mean, all the Ottoman Empire, any empire, in fact, and some were better than others, but any empire eventually gets, well, I can't say. All great empires, sooner or later, their colonialism fails. Sooner or later. And by the way, I once heard a wonderful explanation from Shlomo Avineri about why that's true. Shlomo Avineri is an Israeli political scientist, and he was addressing... It was a lecture I went to in Israel, and he was addressing a group of faculty and diplomats. And he said to them, America can never force Israel to do anything. And he said, and the reason is not relative strength. After all, we're a tiny country, and America is a great country. He said, it has only to do with one thing, and that is attention span. He said, our attention is focused on Israel all day, every day. America is a big power. It has a lot of concerns. It can focus on Israel for a month, but then something will happen in China. something will happen. He said, and you'll have to turn your focus, and all we know, all we have to do is hold on long enough, and sooner or later, your attention will go elsewhere. And what he said, by the way, the inverse of that is the kind of thing that, that resistance fighters in places like Iraq or terrorists think, which is sooner or later, America's going to have to turn its attention somewhere else, but this is all we care about. It's part of the problem of being a great power. It happened to Rome, it happened to Great Britain. You know, Great Britain couldn't only pay attention to India. And when the mutiny happened in, what, 1859 or so, they were all shocked. And they said, well, we're going to hold on now, but sooner or later, you know, you just couldn't keep sending your best and brightest to India to rule a land so far away. And so it's a problematic thing. So anyway, it's also true that throughout the Bible, there is this equation of especially the land of Israel and the virtue of the people who are in it and what happens to them. The Amalekites get wiped out because they're bad. Israel gets preserved because it's good. But in the modern world, obviously it doesn't work that way, especially because we know what's true on a national scale, what Balzac said on an individual scale. He said, every great fortune was founded on a crime, right? The same thing is true of every great country, right? Every great country has a war, a massacre, a genocide in its past. And the lucky country is the country whose genocide is so far in the past that people don't remember it anymore, right? We're in that sort of middle range, the United States. Yes, people remember the Native Americans, but they don't remember it so much that anybody makes a big fuss about it. So our massacre is over 200 years ago, so we're sort of okay. The French, the English, their massacres are, you know, 1,000 years ago. Nobody even thinks about it. It doesn't have any relevance. Israel, unfortunately, was born in historical memory, which means that everything, every displacement, every killing, every war that was a part of the founding of the State of Israel is very alive to people. And that makes it hard. That makes it hard. It's the same reason, by the way, why Kashmir is such a hot spot in the world, because India and Pakistan, the founding of Pakistan and the massacres that followed were right after the Second World War, right? We're in 1945 or so. Or 50-something. I don't remember which year was it? 48. Same year as Israel, yeah. So as a result, you get the biblical morality applied to modern nations. That is, you only get to stay in your nation if you're virtuous enough. And so as long as the Amorite iniquity isn't full, Israel doesn't get to be there, but in time they will. Okay. All right. Then I wanted to go to the very end of it to prepare us now for chapter 16 next time. And once again, next time, remember, is next Thursday, as usual, sort of. Okay. When the sun set and it was very dark, anybody, now that we're somewhat attuned biblical readers, what does that tell you when the sun set and it was very dark?
Creation.
Oh, that's good. I wasn't thinking about that, but that is good. That is a reminiscent of creation. But just, if you're an editor, okay, that's a good way to read the Bible, is to be an editor. And someone wrote, the sun set and it was very dark. What would you say? It's a little repetitious, right? If you said it was very dark, the reader understands that the sun set. If you said the sun set, the reader would understand it's dark, unless you want to emphasize something about the darkness. Okay. Remember, my father once took a class with Philip Reif. Philip Reif is one of the world's experts on Freud, and he's a sociologist. And he taught a class on a single essay on Freud. And they spent the entire semester looking at that one essay, not a book, just one essay. Because he said any great writer chooses his words intentionally. And if you don't pay attention to every word, you'll never understand what he's talking about. And in the course of the class, Reef, who spoke with this very refined English accent but was in fact the son of a kosher butcher from Chicago, said, if you want to learn, that could be him, said, I'll tell you a story about him in a second, but he said, if you want to learn how to read properly, study Talmud. Because the same kind of attention that people give to sacred scriptures is how you're supposed to read. It's what the rabbi said about the Bible. You should read the Bible like a love letter. Every word. What did she mean by that word? Why did she use this word and not the other word? Why didn't she say this? How come she doesn't refer to that? That's how you're supposed to read the Bible. As though every single word has significance. So when the Bible repeats itself, says very dark in the sunset, then you have to ask yourself right away, why is that there? The story I was going to tell you about Philip Reef was he once came to speak at my father's synagogue, and I got to drive him home, which was great because he was a fascinating, and he still is. I mean, he's much older now. He's in his late 80s or early 90s and is, by the way, about to publish 4 books after 15 years of silence. But anyway, he was a very fascinating man, spoke very pretentiously and never used a simple word when a complicated one would do, but he was a very interesting man. So he said to me, as I was driving him back, what do you do? And I was in my last year of college. I said, I'm in my last year of college. He said, what would you like to do with your life? And I said, I don't know exactly, but one thing I know that I'd like to do is I'd like to write. I said, but you know, the truth is I'm very depressed because I was 21 or 22. I said, I just read Norman Mailer's Naked and the Dead, which is a masterpiece. He never wrote another book as good, but that's a separate issue. I said, and he wrote that when he was 26. So I find that depressing. To which Reef said, Keats, he's talking about the poet John Keats. He said, Keats died at 24. Is that an aspiration of yours as well? Which I never forgot that. I thought, okay, you made your point. So anyway, yeah, please. That's okay. I'm filling a lot of time, so we don't have to move on to the next chapter anyway today. So,
I was just going to say that when you said when the sun set and
it was very dark.
And it was very dark. To me, it felt like there was a lot missing in between, because when you say and the sun set, I envision colors in the sky. I don't see it very dark.
Right.
And then there's a space, and then it was very dark. So there's a space missing there for me, not that. It's repetitious.
Well, it's true that the Bible is very undescriptive. You don't get much nature. You don't get much physical description. You don't know. We don't know what Abraham looked like. We have no idea. But you could just say it was very dark. And even if you say the sunset and it was very dark, and you're missing that intermediate piece, the question is, why are you missing that intermediate? Why does God wait till it's very dark? What kind of darkness is it? And the way the commentators usually talk about it is that it wasn't a normal darkness, that the darkness of a divine vision is not like a usual darkness. Remember that there's another darkness in the Bible that also has a special quality, and that's the darkness of Egypt during the plagues, right? That it's not a normal darkness. It's a darkness almost that you can touch or feel. One sec, there was a... No? Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to elaborate on that very point. It seems that in this particular passage that it is very descriptive. Not because it goes out of the way to say the kind of darkness that is, that, as you said, you can feel it. It's the dead. There's a furnace and a flaming torch. It seems...
It's funny. I'll tell you what Rashi says. Rashi says, Hashemesh ba'a, that is the sunset, and he says shkia. Shkia is the time that the sun sets. That's when you start to light candles for Shabbos, is shkia. Okay? And then it says, V'altahaya, or V'alatahaya, choshech hayom, the darkness of the day. Which is a very ambiguous statement.
That's
yeah.
Actually what I was going to say, something like that.
Go ahead.
Dark, the entire night passed. There's no longer stars in the sky. There's no longer a moon. There's no longer other people's fires burning. Everyone has gone to sleep. It's now totally dark just before the dawn. And then there appears smoking up in the flaming torch that passed between the pieces. And on that day, so it's as though we're at that moment right before, the very darkest moment before the dawn of that day.
And I'll quote you from Radak. I brought today Mikraot Gedolot. This is a modern one that's printed in Israel, very nicely printed, so you can actually read it. And these are all these different paragraphs represent different commentators. So Rabbi David Kimchi, who was a commentator we actually referred to last time, said that the darkness is a hint, a remez, a foreshadowing of all the exiles that will befall Israel, darkness is a hint of all the troubles that those exiles will bring. Yes?
I mentioned this last week.
Right. Oh, yes. Say it again. It was a wonderful point.
I don't know that anyone today, knowing that their children or their children's children would suffer so much, would even choose to have children.
Right.
Routinely, when we get married, we have Tay-Sachs testing.
Yeah.
We're concerned about the well-being of one child. And knowing that, you know, just...
That they'll suffer so.
Suffer so much. I don't know
that it's... That it's... Well, I would say, let me give it a rabbi spin. It shows Abraham's ultimate faith in God. That, I mean, and in a way, maybe it's even a foreshadowing of the Akedah, you know, the binding of Isaac. That even though God says your children will suffer, but ultimately it will be good, Abraham says to himself, if God tells me that ultimately it will be good, then I'm willing to have children, even though I know they will suffer. Which is, you know, I don't remember if we talked about it in this class. We did in another class about, and Ellie and I had this conversation with another couple, actually, who were about to have a child. What's more important to you, that your child be good or your child be happy? Because they're not always the same. And you automatically said happy. Happy even if it means that they have to do things that are immoral? It's not so easy, right? It's a very hard question. And probably the only accurate answer is, well, it depends on the situation, you know? If they have to do something truly horrendous to be happy, so you don't want them to. If, you know, once they have to make a mistake on their taxes to be happy, maybe, you know. But in all seriousness, it's not so easy. And being good in this world, as you know, often means being unhappy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you explained this last
time. That's okay.
But now that we're talking about slavery and things like that, I was reading chapter 9 last night, and I noticed something interesting, and I'm sure you've talked about this, that it's verse 25, that Noah, he gets upset because he was intoxicated,
right,
and his children,
yes,
came up. And he cursed Canaan,
right,
a slave of slaves shall be,
right,
his brothers. So is that kind of like history repeating itself, that he cursed that area?
Well,
because it explains a little bit, and it says that this curse resulted in the blessing and curse has influenced the trends of history to this very day.
I'm curious, is that the stone Chumash?
Yes.
I thought so. Okay. So I would say I'll give you at least two different ways of reading it. One is that when it says, I mean, notice that the phrasing in the stone Chumash is very careful. They don't say that Noah's curse caused Canaan to be, but it influenced the trend. And I think there's a way in which when you look back on history, anything historical, you can. If I said to you, why did America become a great power? You could now look back on history and find 100 different reasons why it became a great power. Any one alone probably wouldn't be enough, but with the accumulation of it, and so you can say that Noah's curse was one piece of the puzzle that gradually led to Canaan being dispossessed. Yes. The other way to look at it, and here it depends, and I want to offer this, it depends when you think the Torah was written. If the Torah was written later, then it was people looking back to why they had to explain why was Canaan dispossessed, and so they made sure that Noah cursed his kid Canaan as an explanation after the fact. Either one works, but
they made it up.
But I didn't say that.
No.
I was very, I'm on tape. But they frame the story so that the beginning fits the end. Because it is true often, more often than we think, that we know the end of the story better than the beginning. And so then you get what's called the backstory that has to flow into it. So, yeah. One and then two. Don, go ahead.
I'm curious about when you're talking about the ram.
About the ram.
And we have the ram again over here in 15 and the stars and that.
Right.
Sacrifice. It seems to be, I don't find another sacrifice. This is a foreshadowing, and I'm curious about why three years.
What 3 years?
Well, the ram of 3 years.
Oh, why they're that old. I see. I think 3 years is just sacrificially the first year that you can offer it, because it has to be grown.
In this case, you go from the old to the young.
Okay, but that's I'm not sure that that's tied to this. At least I don't know of it. But in this case, I think it has to be at least 3 years, because anything younger is too young to offer up a cow. You don't offer up a baby cow or a baby ram. That's yeah. Yes, but I don't want to go. I don't want to go to the Akedah now. So let me leave that alone, because there's just yeah. I don't see this so much as a foreshadowing of the Akedah, except in as much as this establishes the idea of sacrifice, of Abraham's sacrifice to God, Abraham's willing sacrifice to God, but it doesn't test like the Akedah tests. Yeah.
Could it be that the darkness that it's talking about is one of sadness and guilt, because he's telling him that your people will be slaves, but you will live to be,
Well, it is an interesting question how Abraham feels, knowing that he's going to be okay, but his grandchildren will suffer. He doesn't even say his children. I mean, it's your descendants. And I don't know. You have to ask yourself, how would you feel, how do you feel knowing that, for example, four generations from now, America will probably not have the same ease, comfort, dominance in the world that it has now? I don't know. The question is, how far does the human quality of empathy go? To your kids, yes. To your grandchildren, yes. Maybe into your great-grandchildren, does it go to five generations? Does it go to six? Are you worried about the people who will be your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren? All I can say is we don't behave as though we were worried about them. So I don't, I'm. It's possible, but I don't see it. Debbie?
I just was thinking along the lines of the
Isaac was, according to the tradition, 37 when he was sacrificed, even though if you read the story, it's clear the context of the story works much better if he's about 12. That's how it feels. But if you work out the chronology, he's actually an adult. So that's one of those tricky things about that story. But yeah.
Well, I was thinking a lot about the prophecy aspect and the free will and determinism, and I wanted to go back to that.
Okay.
Because you said we had enough time.
Yes, and next time we're going to begin. Next time we're going to start on the family stuff. I promise. I was concerned that last time I didn't say we were going to be on Tuesday, so I know some people didn't come, and I didn't want to move on ahead till next week. Go ahead.
I'm delighted, because I almost emailed you.
Good.
A short
prophecy.
Yeah. No, it's free will and determinism, or nature and nurture is a way of looking at that. And in college, I spent a lot of time worrying about that in college, because there was psychology was supposed to be the prediction and the control of behavior, and it bothered me that somebody was going to control my behavior, so I figured I better learn about it. But the thing that I came to is that it's the wrong question, and that there's another way of looking at time, so that time in primary process isn't chronological. And when you actually read the Bible, it's pre-Aristotelian logic, because Maimonides hadn't come along yet, and you have a lot of things in here that is not about time. And
right.
I know that dreams are precognitive, because people have dreams of things that are going to happen in the future. So there's something about this that is not, doesn't take, and then I thought that if he is talking about what's going to happen to the descendants, it may not be determined exactly how they got there by which person did what, but the general flow.
Flow of time. Well, it is true. Yeah, first of all, the rabbis do say there's no early or late in the Torah. They don't assume the Torah works according to chronological time, which is why, even though Isaac is 37, on the other hand, he's 12. It's also true that all myth works according to dream time. As soon as you say once upon a time, you've lifted something out of the realm of normal historical chronology. It's what the best definition of myth I know was by a philosopher, Stephen of Byzantium, an early Christian philosopher, who said, myth is something that never happened, but is always happening. And that's also, you wanted to add something to this?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just that when I talked to my husband about it, who is more of a scientist than I am, and I'm more of a psychologist, he was saying that according to relativity, time is another dimension, and it depends on where you are in the continuum.
Right.
And the idea of God being Ein Sof wouldn't be on the continuum, so there would be a difference.
Right. Well, that's what, I mean, even the medieval said something like that, that God was outside of time, and therefore every action in time not only did not affect him, but he understood it differently from the way we see it, because we're in time. So they did, even though they obviously didn't understand the idea of relativity, but they understood what it was. They understood the concept of things being relative. They didn't understand the idea that space-time curves. But they did get the idea that God could know something in the future, because God was outside of time, and since we experience it in time, we still have choice. But it's still a very hard, even though we can say that, it's still a very hard thing for people to grasp. So, because we live in the world of causes and effects.
The one other thing is, then when you start looking at the pieces and the sacrifice of the pieces, instead of looking at them so, it seems to me that there must have been a way to look at them like analogies.
Well, they were. They were analogies according to the rabbinic tradition for all the kingdoms that would arise and oppress Israel. Each one, the four kingdoms, and we're still, remember, in Edom. We're still in the last kingdom. We talked about that last time. Well, there are two different. There are two different interpretations of that. One is that the bird was the birds of prey that are the enemy of Israel. There were two. I gave it to you on the sheet, which you may or may not have. One was an internal analogy, which was 1 second. Hold it. I'll give it to you. The internal analogy was from Malbim, and he says, the bird is his soul, which had not been divided and had not died in him, but was still living and governing his flesh. And the other one was from Ramban, who said that the bird was, 1 second, was not divided, because in sacrifices later on in the Bible, the bird is the one animal that you don't divide up. But what you said also sparked something else that I was going to say, but now I can't remember. About the operations of time in the Bible. But I'll leave it for now, unless it comes back to me. Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of the idea that God prepares himself for inflicting the wound. That in some way is sort of taken out of the context of time. It appears that way, but it's...
Right. Well, remember I talked last time about Maimonides. I didn't talk in this, it was in the other class, about Maimonides says that all the miracles that happen in the course of history, the talking donkey, the sun standing still, all those things were prepared by God before the creation of the world. Because Maimonides doesn't like the idea that God breaks the order of nature. So instead, he says, these are all programmed into the order of nature. From the beginning of time, that donkey was going to talk. It was just a function of getting to the moment when Bilam, which makes the world very deterministic. Very deterministic. But still, Maimonides assumes that people have free will. And this is not, it isn't a question that has an easy, or it doesn't have a single answer that every religious philosopher would accept. But these kinds of paradoxes are not strange to philosophy. I mean, it's like Zeno's paradoxes, if any of you remember Zeno's paradoxes, which people still work on. Zeno's paradoxes are, there are several of them, but here's an example, the paradox of the tortoise and the hare. Zeno said, you know, Aesop's fable about the tortoise and the hare, that the hare starts first, and then the tortoise is much faster, but the hare slow and steady. According to Zeno, if the hare, that is the rabbit, was one step ahead, then if the tortoise was one step ahead, the hare could never catch up to him. Because as soon as you're ahead, in order for someone to catch up to you, first they have to reach where you are, and by the time they've reached where you are, you're already ahead. And then they have to reach where you are again, but once they do, you're already ahead. So in fact, if you take a first step, no one can ever catch up to you. Here's another paradox from Zeno. I can never get to the other side of this room, said Zeno, because first I have to go halfway. And before I can do that, I have to go half of that, and half of that, and half of that, and half of that, and half of that infinitely, so that I can actually never move. Now, Zeno obviously walked across rooms. He knew that these things weren't true. But in order to prove that they're not true, I mean, even Bertrand Russell, who was one of the great mathematical minds of the 20th century, spent a long time trying to refute Zeno's paradoxes. So the human mind has a very difficult time in making sense of the way we know things work, even though we feel intuitively that we know they work that way. We feel free will, yet we understand that someone can somehow know, but they can't know, because if they know, then how do we have free will? It's hard, and there are all sorts of solutions, but none of them are completely satisfactory. Quantum physics has sort of helped by saying that, in fact, the world isn't deterministic. There's a lot of randomness, even on a subatomic level, but that's only today's physics. I don't know what's going to happen in 50 years, so who knows? Anyway, I don't know how we got to this, but it's interesting. It is interesting stuff, after all, and the operations. And I would say that on a larger level, it is the operations of family that provide the Bible with most of its randomness and interest in the Book of Genesis. And I want to just close by preparing us for next time. Next time, what we're going to talk about is the fact that Abraham, who has just pleaded for a child, is about to get one. It's just that he's not going to get the child that he thinks he's supposed to get. But he gets a child, and then there is the first, I actually think it's the first conflict between husband and wife. Adam and Eve didn't really have a conflict, right? First Adam listened to Eve, and then he blamed her. That's not exactly a conflict. They didn't get a chance to fight with each other. They just got a chance to fight in front of the judge. But in terms of an actual conflict between the two, this is the first portrait of a marriage we get, is Abraham and Sarah. For better and worse, by the way. All the marriages, as Joseph Telushkin once said to me, and this is a good note on which to close. He said to me, sometimes people will say to him, I don't understand why Judaism outlaws polygamy. After all, there were several people in the Bible who were polygamous. And he said, and I always say to them, that's true, but all of them were unhappy because of it. And it's true. Jacob, you know, with Rachel and Leah was not happy, and Abram with Sarai and Hagar was not happy, and, you know, it never works. So maybe the Bible is teaching by negativity, right? It's not that you can't do this, but I want you to know if you do it, right, exactly, you will be miserable. Yeah, Jane? What's that? Who was? That's a good question. Who was happy? David wasn't happy. Moses wasn't happy. The happy ones are the ones you don't hear about. Right. I'm sure Aaron was happy because we don't hear anything about his wife. Let's see. Hold it. Ruth. Ruth was happy. That's who was happy. Can we think of anyone else? Who else was happy? What's that? Well, Esther might have been happy. That's a trickier one, though. Yeah, Ruth was a convert. But the point is, she married one person, and one person was married to her.
How do we know that she was happy?
The portrait. I mean, if you read the book, the portrait is, and as much as we see of it, it was happy. I don't know what happens. I don't know what happened years later. I don't think that the Bible is taken by the idea that there is a blissful, perfect state called marriage. I think that it's much more taken by the idea that life is hard and it's difficult and that you share it with someone, and that doesn't make it smooth. It means that the difficulties aren't shared alone. That's what, you know, as I quoted yesterday to somebody, Phyllis Diller's immortal line, she said, you should never go to bed angry, you should stay up and fight, right? And that's more or less what you see in the Bible. People stay up and fight. But in the end, the triumph is, obviously, that the family gets bigger and it grows and it creates an ideology and it creates a people and it does, and it transmits the values from generation to generation, which is what you are supposed to do. And I think that the Bible would answer that the issue is not to make your child happy, but to make your child good. And that, you know, goodness, happiness will hopefully be a byproduct of fulfilling the human purpose in this world. So
the ones who do bad are unhappy.
Yes, one hopes. Yeah, manages. Okay. All right, yes, last question, and then we'll...
Sure. You touched this issue last week about what it was in the context of someone who converts from Judaism and converts back to
right.
Judaism. Who's considered a Jewish?
If you're born to a Jewish mother, you're Jewish. If you convert to Judaism, you're Jewish. Those are the two ways you can be Jewish. In the Reform movement today, if you are born to a Jewish mother or a Jewish father and raised Jewish, then you are considered Jewish. But classically, it is you're born to a Jewish mother, and or you convert to Judaism according to Jewish law. All right? Okay. That class was 47 minutes and 44 seconds. Just call Rebecca, and she'll arrange it.
I want to ask you about Shurmiyatism last week. About the Quran, which states that it was not Ishmael. So what is it in the Quran?
The same as there are some differences. Abraham is the father of Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac becomes the father of the Jewish people. Ishmael becomes the father, thanks, of the Muslim.
So he's thought of with great esteem in the Quran.
Yes, Abraham is the father of right. That's why
the father of the lead
of the father Islamic, of the Islamic faith. They think of him as the founder of the Islamic faith. Right. But Muhammad came along because the tradition had been so corrupted over years, came along and gave the correct version of what God's word was.
And do they discuss Brit and that?
Ishmael has a Brit at 13, which is when they do. So, and on that, I think we've got it better. I'm happier with our system. But yeah, they do. They do. You know, if you look in any, if you go on the web and just look introduction to Islam, you'll get the, in a nutshell, the way it works. But there was a guy, I don't know if he's still doing it, at UCLA, who used to have a Jewish-Christian Islamic dialogue, and he called it the Abrahamic Covenant, because all three
readily and easily acknowledge Abraham as the founder of their faith. So there was no argument about Abraham. Right. But as soon as you went beyond Abraham, you started to get an argument. But Abraham, everybody has.
I don't have the picture.
Just before the class last week, I had read Marion Pearl's and she references, right toward the end of the book, she references Ishmael going up. And I thought, there can't be a mistake. And it was just before your class, and yet I didn't know. So that explained a lot. All right, thank you.
My big question is the love letter will die because of the computer.
No, I mean, we're just...
That I know.
We were thinking of going away, but we're not going to do it.
Okay.
Oh, this is... I thought it stopped.